Well, thank you very much, Catherine, and thank you all for attending. I'm grateful to both groups for inviting me to speak to a joint meeting. On the PIL side, I commend the efforts of the PIL group to deal with different topics within public international law to avoid continuing to produce a professional regime of sub-specialists. So I welcome the practical defragmentation that I think is one aim, or at least a consequence, and I hope that in a small way I can contribute to that, that my own efforts have been on a parallel path. I'm honored to follow past speakers such as Mads and Danis and Chaloka Bayani, and I simply hope I can provide something that is in the league, if not at the standard of what you've had from these very distinguished individuals. Can you hear me? I mean, is the microphone located well as far as you're concerned? Good. Well, I'm going to use slides. The overall topic on which I'll focus is one topic within the book. It's not the dominant topic within the book. A number of inquiries came out of the effort. But the topic I'll reach and deal with in greatest detail is the identification of the reference country for purposes of the determination of refugee status. And the reference country, or the primary reference country, is denoted by the phrase the country of his nationality in Article 1A2 of the Refugee Convention. But the intention behind the book, one was to clarify the interpretation of Article 1A2 in light of an assessment of the PIL relating to nationality and the absence of nationality, that is, statelessness. My original starting point, professionally, was involvement in a large number of cases concerning the deprivation of nationality as against individuals of Eritrean background by Ethiopia after the outbreak of conflict between those two countries in 1998. And I dealt with a large number of cases leading to two important successes in the Court of Appeal with leading counsel in both cases, EB Ethiopia and then MA Ethiopia. MA Ethiopia unsuccessful on the day and successful a month later after MA had been to the Ethiopian embassy to clarify her position, satisfying the evidential requirement. And that left me knowing a lot about deprivation of nationality and how I thought deprivation of nationality worked into Article 1A2 as persecution. The interpretive route was, of course, human rights. ICCPR Article 12.4 was extremely important in that context. And other international cases, comparative examination of international cases. But the effort I embarked on in doing the book was to look at Article 1A2 and indeed other aspects of Article 1 and to deal with those in light of a proper understanding of the PIL related to nationality. And if I may, I'll use nationality from now on as including statelessness rather than repeat and statelessness formulaically. And that I found required a start much earlier, and there was much less to go on. I found myself dealing with commentary that was that had acquired a considerable age without there being a modern treatment of the content of the PIL relating to nationality and how that related to refugee status. And so it became, in essence, a larger task. It expanded. The justification for interest in the topic, I'd suggest, is that nationality, as Catherine indicated in her introduction, is a fundamental aspect of the definitional provisions in Article 1A2, but there is a fragmentation in several directions. One is between practitioners domestically in this and other jurisdictions and the PIL world, and another maybe amongst individuals dedicated to subspecialties, and both within the academic study of law and within the profession. And another reason to be interested in this is that refugee law is an area in which domestic courts routinely consider PIL. It's relatively rare in that context, and it's a good reason for comparative interest. And my feeling as a practitioner, looking at the development of understanding of refugee law, is that certainly in the last 30 years, the period in which there's been considerable litigation, broadly the outcome is highly successful. Broadly you can say that the development and consolidation of jurisprudence has given a rational and highly defensible outcome. These areas I'm coming to in the book may show some signs of exception, some fraying, through being areas that are less consistently dealt with or receive less attention by practitioners. So the relevance of nationality, Article 1A2, the definition begins, owing to well-founded fear, the rest of that formula is familiar. Nationality is one of the reasons for persecution, which admits qualification, that is, it is a convention reason, is outside the country of his nationality. So alienation from the country of his nationality is critical, and that the well-founded fear relates to that country. And then you find the protection of that country, and not having nationality and being outside the country of his former habitual residence as the fallback. Importantly, and in distinction, for example, to what happens in international protection under PIL, in this specific treaty regime, in the case of a person who has more than one nationality, every nationality falls for consideration. No nationality is deducted, and that's explicit in the text. So I've set out there the aspects in respect of which nationality is relevant, and you've already, I think, taken that from the text of Article 102. Nationality is also relevant in respects that I won't have time to deal with today in any detail, and those are cessation and exclusion. Those are broadly reflective of the uses of nationality on the way into the regime, the qualification provisions, and they're dealt with in the book at chapters 7 to 8. And I want to refer briefly to the starting point of the work before I come to my main topic today, which was deprivation of nationality as persecution under Article 1A2. The starting point in this country was the observation of Lord Justice Hutchinson in Lazarevich. If a state arbitrarily excludes one of its citizens, thereby cutting him off from enjoyment of all those benefits, rights enjoyed by citizens, and duties owed by state to its citizens, there is, in my view, no difficulty in accepting that such conduct can amount to persecution. Such a person may properly say both that he's being persecuted and that he fears persecution in the future. That was the subject of EB and MA. It's the subject of an important German decision and of three decisions in the United States. There's an older Australian decision. This is dealt with in the book at chapter 6 in much more detail. But the conclusion I come to is that it is now possible to say that generally, that is, in most circumstances, a deprivation of nationality that is arbitrary in international law terms, that involves the imposition of statelessness, or the effective imposition of statelessness, and that is entered into by reason of a convention reason, is likely to be persecutory. Around that, there are other phenomena on which the jurisprudence is less clear. On that point, I think there's a consensus, but there are other nationality-related points, such as the denial of nationality to people with a strong connection to the territory, and the treatment of resident aliens, and indeed change of status, a phenomenon of the Nuremberg Law in Germany in the 1930s, was that in the face of strong international reaction to earlier laws, which had amounted to outright deprivation of nationality, it left in place nationality, but in essence created the class of citizens from which Jews and others were excluded. That is, within nationality, it created a differential citizenship regime. And the creation of such a regime, depending on the circumstances, may, I think, also almost certainly in some circumstances be persecutory. But moving on from that, leaving that to the book, the primary topic I want to deal with today is the identification of the reference country for purposes of Article 1A2, country or countries. The reasons for this choice: one, this concept is critical to the Article 1A2 definition. And two, this term informs others. This is the root in that informs the cessation and exclusion provisions. It also informs the phrase the protection of that country. Three, this is an area of strong public international law content. My earlier reference to fragmentation reflects, in my view, a divorce between refugee law practitioners and PIL scholars, whereby refugee law has often been practiced without acknowledging the underlying role of nationality law in informing the basic terms of qualification. And finally, this is an area where there is an absence of consensus in the comparative case law. And on that basis, it's an area that's particularly rewarding to study. So this reflects my section headings in the general introduction. I found that what I'd meant as a very short introductory chapter turned into, in essence, a re-examination of nationality law. International nationality law, the brief story, the bullet point on this, in my respectful view, is that from a position of there being almost no international law of nationality, by 1930, the 1930 convention, there was a position by which the international community had begun to establish limited norms, primarily for the purpose of addressing conflict. International law scholars of the 1930s thought in many cases that they could look forward to the development of a coherent regime, starting with conflict situations, carrying on with common principles, and going to some form of global codification of minimum standards. That has never happened. What has happened is the development of sub-regimes, in particular the regimes concerning statelessness, and the foundation and development of international human rights law, which informs the content of nationality law, and the identification of strong international standards, include in relation to genocide and discrimination in the jurisprudence, notably in Barcelona traction. So, general definition, there are, in essence, two concepts. And Paul Weiss, who wrote the primary monograph on this, Nationality and Statelessness, it first published 1956, republished in 1979 with very limited changes. The term has two principal meanings. One, political legal term, denoting membership of a state, which must be distinguished from nationality as a historical biological term, denoting membership of a nation. And he noted that the use of the same term for two notions wasn't simply accidental, it reflected the development of the law on top of certain beliefs about communities. The dictionary definitions, the Oxford English Dictionary sets out several meanings, and what one leads to in terms of the root concept nation is this: an extensive aggregate of persons so closely associated with each other by common descent, language, or history as to form a distinct race or people, usually organized as a separate political state and occupying a definite territory. So that expresses both sides of the Weiss definition. In early examples, the racial idea is usually stronger than the political. In recent use, the notion of political unity and independence is more prominent. Now, if you consider whether we are at a watershed today, if you agree with Werner Müller that populism is defined by the identification of others as not part of a community, it's defined by exclusionary language, then you might think we begin to move back towards a stronger use, or at least some members of our community begin to move back towards a different use from the use that the OED identifies as more prevalent in modern times. So nationality means, of course, not simply membership of the state, but membership or affiliation denoting attachment to the state for purposes of international law. Messi and Minister of the Interior, the Egyptian Conseil d'Etat, and you have observations by Plender and Dürr there. The Nottebohm case, the International Court of Justice in 1955, part of the judgment, which is often referred to, says that nationality is a legal bond having as its basis a social fact of attachment, a genuine connection of existence, interests, and sentiments, together with the existence of reciprocal rights and duties. Now, the definition goes on, but time is limited, and so I leave it on the paper. But the Nottebohm case concerned international protection. Mr. Nottebohm had begun as a German national. He and his family had very large trading interests in Guatemala. He spent much of his life in Guatemala. At the outbreak of the Second World War, perhaps motivated by a concern that if Guatemala entered the war against Germany, his assets would be susceptible to confiscation and he to internment, he went back to Germany. He traveled to Liechtenstein and was naturalized after a very short stay in Liechtenstein, making a large financial payment for the waiver of the residence requirement. He lost his German nationality by becoming a citizen of another state, and so he went back to Guatemala, a national of Liechtenstein. Sometime later, of course, Guatemala did enter the war on the side of the United States and Britain. He was interned. He was taken to a U.S. Marines base and thence to Arizona, where he remained for a number of years in internment. Whilst he was in internment, his commercial interests were denuded from him by people in Guatemala. And Judge Reed, giving the dissenting view, said, well, if you looked at this substantively, you might well think that there had been an international delict against him by Guatemala. But he traveled after the war to Liechtenstein to rely on his nationality, and initiated through Liechtenstein protective action against Guatemala. And essentially, the International Court of Justice declined to accept that he could rely upon his Liechtenstein nationality as giving a basis for its protection against Guatemala, with which he had a very strong connection. Now, it's a case that you might well think is a case of its time. There are strong and, to me, really, really very convincing dissents by Judge Reed and others. Its continuing relevance is certainly in the context of international protection, but it's also relevant that you don't get asked what connection you have with the state every time you present its passport. I have three passports. I'm entitled, for example, to an American passport. I've never earned an American dollar. I've never lived as an adult in the United States. No one asks me, if I produce the passport, whether I have a sufficient connection to be a US citizen. And so the connection denoted by Notabone may be quite a minimal one, if you see a relevance for the decision outside international protection at all. Next, the relationship between national and international law. And I've outlined this very briefly earlier. In essence, the classical position was that this was virtually uniquely a sphere of domestic sovereignty. Over time, there's been increased identification of the scope for international standards to apply. And Brownlee notes an early observation of Manley Hudson, who I think was a relative conservative on this point. In principle, questions of nationality fall within the domestic jurisdiction of each state. But Brownlee also concludes, this is James Crawford, the 8th edition, that in modern practice there are substantial limitations upon the recognition of national actions. The watershed, the Tunis and Morocco case, the question whether a certain matter is within the jurisdiction of a state is an essentially relative question depending on the development of international relations. And the 1930 Convention, Article 1, it's for each state to determine under its own law who are its nationals. But recognition depends on the meeting of other standards. At that time, the other standards were highly disputed and were certainly extremely limited. But subsequently, you can say that the Barcelona Attraction Standards and the international human rights regime has considerable input into nationality through the formula reflected in Article 1. And Article 2, any question as to whether a person possesses the nationality shall be determined in accordance with the law of the state. So, contrasting nationality and citizenship, citizenship is your domestic membership, your citizenship in the state for purposes of domestic law. Nationality is its extension in general onto the international plane. I'm going to move forward to a few propositions which I can deal with relatively briefly. One, nationality requires the existence of a state. That's described by Maya Sally Fidel, the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Refugees, Asylum Seekers, Migrants, and IDPs in Africa, as the first obvious fact. The concept of nationality is consubstantial with the concept of the state. There are certain modes of acquisition or loss which are certainly more prevalent in practice, and that is acquisition by birth on the territory, or by descent, ius sola, ius sanguinis, or by derivative acquisition, by naturalization or some other means, and loss, renunciation, deprivation, substitution, and so on. Nationality and the operation of its laws by the state. The 1954 Convention, Article 1, Definition of Statelessness, imports the phrase the operation of its law, which you don't find in the 1930 Convention, Article 1. Now, the 1954 Convention definition has been said to represent customary international law, that's likely a disputed statement, and certainly the extent to which, the purpose for which, it represents CIL may also be disputed. The Supreme Court in the UK has had to consider the question relatively recently, but deferred any authoritative answer on the precise meaning of the 54 Convention definition on this point. The incidence of nationality, what happens because of it, in general, it includes the right to enter or remain in the country of nationality under domestic law. And on the international plane, as a matter of human rights, it often includes a right of entry. And as a matter of what you could call traditional PIL, that is the law of states, a state is expected to accept its national faced with expulsion by another state if there is no other place to which that person may go. So entry, number two, international protection, which is of course well known to the PIL people here. Under international law, it's a mode of protection of an individual by a state. Certainly before the Second World War, when the theory was that domestically a state could do almost anything to its people, you were much better protected as a foreigner, potentially with access to international protection on the territory of a state. The relevance may have been reduced by international human rights law, but remains present in certain circumstances. And internal protection, largely a matter of legal theory, but it's certainly held by some experts, vice quoted Jelinek, that there is some level of internal legal protection which a national may claim from his state of nationality as a matter of political theory. Dual or plural nationality, of course, plural nationality, multiple nationality can arise in different ways. Individuals may be nationals of more than one state. Plural nationality is much more common than it used to be. And that's very largely for good reason, because nationality law in its former operation was highly sexist. Many women lost their nationality on marriage. Many children only carried the nationality of their fathers. A consequence of that is that many people have second or further nationalities of which they may be scarcely aware through nationality systems in domestic law that give nationality on the basis of descent, for example, the German or Dutch systems traditionally. The minimum content, there's no convincing authority that there is any minimum content at all as a matter of international law in the concept of nationality. A state can say to individuals, you are our national, but you have no rights as such against us. That may be a breach of its international law duties to others, but it is not a breach. It isn't something that voids the concept of nationality as applied in the case. And effective nationality, it's a phrase which I think deserves considerable criticism used in the refugee context. It's used in multiple contexts in international law. Number one, international protection, the Cannavaro case, the Iran-US Claims Tribunal. It's essentially used where more than one nationality exists to single out the relevant nationality for a particular purpose. Next, it's sometimes used as a term that says a legal status of nationality is effective in that it does what you expect of a nationality. But to know what that means, you have to specify the respect in which nationality does what you expected it to do in the first place. So the phrase is potentially very hollow and potentially misleading. Third, to make things worse, there's another possible reading of the phrase effective nationality, which is pretty much the opposite of the one I just identified, because something that isn't a nationality in law, something that isn't a nationality at all, not a de jure nationality, might be said by some to constitute an effective nationality if in some specified respect it's like a nationality. So it's similar to a nationality, but not a nationality. So of those two, small Roman two, it is a nationality and it does what you expect it to do. Number three, it isn't like a nationality, but it does do something you would expect a nationality to do. A10, this is a topic I don't have time to enter into at length. I've written an article which has been published thanks to the editors of the International Journal of Refugee Law about recognition and non-recognition in relation to the index country in cases of denationalization. If a state denationalizes you in a way that's persecutory but effective in domestic law, does that state stop being the reference state when you go across the border and your claim is assessed? I think it probably doesn't, for reasons I've set out in the article. Lauterpacht and others have set out considerable learning on recognition, which is broadly not applied by domestic law practitioners or refugee law. Through lack of confidence, lack of understanding, lack of knowledge, indeed, of its existence. And opposability. Opposability may mirror recognition, but really arises in a different context. And unfortunately, the words are sometimes used interchangeably. I use opposability as indicating whether a state is one that can be relied on as against another state in the bilateral context. So opposability primarily restricted to international protection, though potentially relevant beyond that. Now, we reach the main topic, the country of his nationality, and I'll deal very quickly with some preliminaries which simply follow on from what I've indicated. One, the cases, those show pressures both to extend the definition beyond a currently held nationality, which generally result from fear of abuse of the system. That is, you could get another nationality. If you had that, you could go to that country and not be at risk. Therefore, we have to read you out of the regime. We have to interpret you out of the regime. And two, there are other pressures, which sometimes may be reactive to the first set of pressures, to exclude from consideration states which really are states of nationality, on the basis that you can end up getting persecuted, so you interpret out another bunch of states. I think both of those are mistaken, essentially for the following reasons. What I've set out here, it's much less a survey than what you have in the book. Apologies to Australia and Canada, because what you're about to see are primarily illustrations of respects in which I think the Canadians have been the leaders going wrong, and then the Australians have gone wrong in a sympathetic but understandable way. They're not unique. UK courts have flirted with the same concepts. New Zealand has flirted with the same concepts. The United States has not, so far as my research could determine, and Germany has not. But those are essentially the narrowing down from the survey to the core of it to allow a useful, intelligent examination, I hope, today of what happens in the cases. So, first of all, the extension of the definition motivated by abuse concerns. Boyanova. In Boyanova, the evidence was she was a former national of the USSR, claiming asylum in Canada, formerly resident in Latvia. And the authorities had this very ambivalent record of a dialogue with the embassy that uses language, on the one hand, that indicates she is a national and we will give her a passport acknowledging her nationality, and on the other hand, she will become a national through coming to the embassy and us putting a stamp in her extant USSR passport. That's a very common confusion, but it's important that it's a confusion that has to be resolved case by case. In international law, there's a great difference between being someone who is a national and whose nationality would be recognized by the issuance of a document, or acknowledged by the issuance of a document, and someone who has yet to have nationality. A major reason for that is that there's no protective duty at all to someone who could have your nationality or might have your nationality but doesn't. Yeah, no protective duty in international law in those circumstances in general. So the Boyanova case, Ms. Justice Rothstein, in my view, the applicant, by simply making a request and submitting her passport to be stamped, becomes a citizen of Russia. That rather unfortunately follows the road of saying, well, her citizenship is created by the stamp, rather than her citizenship is acknowledged by the stamp. That's followed by a case called Desai, and the claimant was of Indian background, and the court held that Indian citizenship was available on application if he presented himself at an Indian diplomatic office with evidence of the birth of his parents in India, and then had his Indian citizenship confirmed. It's not clear whether that's about the grant of citizenship, again, or the acknowledgement of it. Gregorian is about the law of return, which has caused considerable confusion in this context. I think there are other people here who are certainly very strong experts in that. And then Boyanova was applied in a narrow context correctly, I'd accept, in Katkova, Justice McEwen. That is, distinguishing between having a nationality which needs to be acknowledged and not having a nationality but being able to apply for it. However, from then on, you find both tracks continue. So De Rojas, naturalized citizen of Venezuela, it was held that she wasn't a refugee because she could regain the nationality of Colombia in due course, so that Colombia felt to be treated, though it wasn't a country of nationality at that time, as a second country of nationality. And that's reliant, it says, on Boyanova, but of course Boyanova had this ambivalence between two concepts of acknowledgement or grant. De Barros, Brazilian nationals, the claim rejected because they had state protection available in Portugal. The applicant's father was a citizen of Portugal, so the applicant was eligible to obtain Portuguese citizenship, and refused. Next, an important case, Canada against Williams. Considerable water had gone under the bridge by then, and it was treated as established principle in Canada that if you could get another nationality, that felt to be treated as a country of your nationality for purposes of Article 1A2 on the initial assessment. In Williams, the individual due to domestic precedent didn't stand on principle, but said, well, what you're expecting is something further because I would have to reject my current nationality in order to regain the nationality of a second country, which I'd lost by operation of law at 18. And the Federal Court of Appeal, this is the senior decision in the area in Canada, held that wasn't sufficient distinction. So it recalibrated the approach. Para 22, Justice Descarrie, the true test, in my view, is the following. If it is within the control of the applicant to acquire the citizenship of a country with respect to which he has no well-founded fear, the claim will be denied. And so that represents the status quo in Canada. It's said that the principle has been recognized in various cases and sources. I could go point by point through the authority cited to point out that to identify the fact that it's authority for some different proposition rather than the proposition it's cited there as authority for. And so the decision below was quashed, the decision that the non-country of nationality, which could become a country of nationality after renouncing your first nationality and applying for the second one, was in fact your country of nationality for relevant purposes. Roncalliolo Peruvian Navy officer sought asylum in Canada. His wife and children held French citizenship. It's understandable that as regards those persons, the wife and children, France was a relevant country, but the husband was refused recognition as a refugee on the basis that he could naturalize in due course as a French citizen by reason of marriage. Fabiano, the Argentine-Italian case, relatively similar. That is, you'd have to apply for citizenship in Italy, but here the court rejected the approach because it was held that it was speculative to assert that he could get Italian citizenship. In fact, it wasn't possible to do it from Canada. It would involve being in Italy. He had no means of getting to Italy, and being in Italy for a period whilst that application was pursued. And so you have a divergent decision in Fabiano. And there are other cases. Alvarez, Juanma goes the other way, and Kim, South Koreans, along with the law of return, South Koreans, North Koreans, is another point. That's a perennial favorite in the comparative jurisprudence. And Tibetans, the test of the Canadian approach, quite a lot of cases about Tibetans resident in India claiming asylum in Canada. The cases go two ways. Sometimes that seems to turn evidentially on whether they have an Indian passport, which may be mistaken, because a passport is often not evidence of nationality, and certainly in this context. In other cases, it's based on whether it's concluded that they have it under their control to get Indian citizenship. Now, there have been decisions of superior courts in India that Tibetans born in India had become Indian citizens, but the Indian administration refuses to acknowledge those as binding precedents more widely. And so the cases that conclude it is within your control essentially posit it is within your control to go to India to litigate to the Indian, to the High Court of your state or the Indian Supreme Court in order to establish your rights. And on the basis that that's all within your control, you are not a refugee today as regards return to Tibet. Of course, the consequence is if you're not a refugee because it's judged you could ultimately gain Indian nationality, you can be returned in the absence of any other restraint to Tibet or to China. And so I've dealt with those cases. Next, discounting of nationality on the basis that it's not effective. I've pointed to the problems with the effective nationality paradigm. It's simply vague. It's a phrase that can be interpreted in diametrically opposite senses. But some courts understandably feel pressure to discount nationality where it appears to pose an obstacle to important objectives of the regime. And that primarily arises where there's a second or further nationality and where for some reason practical protection, access to the territory, doesn't appear to be extant. Now, an obstacle to that is unlike international protection law, where you single out one country from several for certain purposes, in refugee law, expressly, the regime requires you to treat as the country of your nationality in the first para of Article 1A2, every country of nationality. And the regime does not discriminate for this purpose among countries of nationality. Article 1A2, para 2 makes them all equal. They all go into the mix, is my respectful view. That's clear from para 2. And the best known cases, two decisions of the Federal Court of Australia, Yong Kim Koe and Lei Kon Chi. Both of those dealt with East Timorese and whether they were entitled to Portuguese citizens, and if so, to Portuguese citizenship, and if so, what that meant in practical terms for them, and whether that obviated a claim to refugee status or to protection status in Australian terms. In Lei Kon Chi, Mr. Justice Finkelstein concluded, in my view, looking to the handbook and the purpose and object of the convention. Effective nationality is a nationality that provides all the protection and rights to which a national is entitled to receive under customary or conventional international law. So it's difficult to get a full list of what those are. It lends an inherent uncertainty to what is a country of nationality. It also lends a problem in that if every country of nationality is equal in being a relevant country for Article 1A2, Power 1 purposes, then does that mean you can't get asylum, you can't get refugee status on the basis of your position vis-a-vis a state because it doesn't afford you all of the protection and rights to which a national is entitled to receive under customary or conventional international law? That would be absolutely perverse. It would be a reversal of the, a negation of the regime. In KK and others, it's a decision with some weaknesses, but also some strengths in a tribunal where I've had many interesting exchanges. In KK, Mr. Ockleton and Senior Immigration Judge Gleeson conclude that the real issue is one of the availability of protection. And in that, and in an earlier conclusion, that you do have to treat countries equally, that there is no separate regime extant only for dual for second or further nationalities, the decision's absolutely correct, I suggest. And so, conclusions. Number one, and coming to the towards the end. Major conclusions, country of his nationality, that does mean country of current nationality, not country of potential future nationality. Important reasons for that. One, there's a clear meaning of international law, of nationality in public international law. It's absolutely a hard-edged or silver line concept in international law rather than a malleable one. There may be some difficulties in application, but conceptually it's clear. Two, the drafters could have adopted some alternative formula to cover connectedness short of nationality. And to me, the best example of this is ICCPR Article 12, the formula his own country, to denote a strong level of connectedness, not necessarily restricted to holders of nationality. Three, if a wider meaning applies, then it should apply generally. That is, the individual should also be able to qualify for asylum on the basis of that wider definition. So you should be able to qualify for refugee status on the basis of a well-founded fear of persecution focused on a state of which you are not a national. Subject to other matters being satisfied. And no serious commentator has, to my knowledge, suggested that to be the case. Four, the regime treats the possibility of application to a non-national country for citizenship or entrance, not at Article 1, but at Article 31, which shows that the drafters were not ignorant of the possibility of recourse to a non-national country. Five, a country of potential but not actual nationality, I'm sorry, that's a typo, generally has no current duty to admit or protect. There may be exceptional duties based on particular circumstances, but in general, the duty of protection is not extant as regards a country of potential rather than actual nationality. And six, doubts about the wider definition are supported, in my respectful view, by the failure to find and apply any adequate bright line rule. Look at the Canadian cases, look at the confusion into which those descend, look at the attempt in the Williams case at a redefinition, and then how that goes when you come to the Tibetans in India cases. And look also at the differing approaches of commentators And there is no viable bright line position for country of nationality going beyond actual country of nationality. And I'm grateful to Dr. Hugo's story for pointing out in an exchange the final point, which isn't in the book, which is that most commentators agree that status determination is based on current facts. It's a very current, though it may be a forward-looking examination. So status doesn't in general, for example, attach when an individual hasn't left his or her country, you know, where one of the requirements of the definition is not at that stage yet met. Conclusion two. In relation to the attempt to discount countries of nationality by treating them as second or third countries of nationality and as not sources of, not venues of effective nationality, those cases are, I think, well-meaning but conceptually wrong. We may not owe the Australians a debt in the rest of the common law world because they so often overturn their case law by statute, which is invisible to us doing a search on the case on a case law database. But you do have to respect the purpose that was in the mind of those judges. And what that means is that you have to accept that if there is a state of nationality, which is a non-persecutory state of nationality, in respect of which there is, in essence, a reasonable and viable alternative, which I've attempted to codify for purposes of discussion a bit further in the book, then that is acceptable. That person is not a refugee. But instead of a vague concept of effective nationality, you have to think about the objects and purposes of the refugee regime. And you can find, I think, a parallel in the commentary and cases about internal flight. I've called this, rather than internal flight alternative, national protection alternative. So the circumstances in which, in my respectful view, there is not a national protection alternative and someone should be recognized as a refugee notwithstanding the existence of a non-persecutory country of nationality is, one, refoulement. If there's a relevant risk of refoulement, fairly obviously. Two, if there's a relevant risk of non-ambition, which would perpetuate the risk of refoulement to the index state. Three, if relevant risk arises based on factual circumstances, which are so adverse as to generate relevant pressure either to refoulement or to self-refoulement, that is, if the state of nationality being considered as one which is sinking under the waves and will disappear in a week, under the Pacific, if it is the venue for severe civil conflict, famine, civil war, epidemic, ecological collapse, in those cases, then the presence of a nationality doesn't provide a viable national protection alternative. And so, well, thank you very much. And refugee law, we live in challenging times, if I can just close on this, but equally, we have a regime. They didn't have a regime, or they didn't have any sustained regime in the 30s. This regime is part of a series of values and norms which are very attractive to people. That is, they reflect well on the civilizations that have developed and upheld them. If you see so-called Islamic State in the Levant, for example, trying to discredit refugee protection in Europe because it wants there to be seen as being no alternative set of values. It wants every other set of values to be seen as hypocritical or self-devoted. The maintenance and the correct understanding of and operation of the regime is extremely important. And so, well, once again, thank you all very much.